Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
And welcome back to another episode of Asian Not Asian Podcast, the podcast where two Asian guys not from Asia talk about American issues no American cares about. I'm your host, Fumi Abe.
And I'm Mike Nguyen.
Today is March 6th, coming at you live from Brooklyn, New York. If you're listening to this on your phones right now, please take a screenshot, post it on your Instagram stories, tag us at Asian Not Asian Pod, and we will regram it, and you'll be famous because we have 12,000 followers, and that's a lot. That's a lot for my life.
Hey, that's a lot for two Asian dudes, you know?
That's what I'm saying, two straight Asian guys. That's a big accomplishment. And if you're an Apple podcast listener, please leave a review. That's super important. And before we get into the story of the week, just want to give a quick shout out to our newest Patreon members. If you join our Patreon, we give you a shout out on the podcast. So our three newest members of this week, we got Stephen Chowporn, C-H-A-W-P-O-R-N. That's a shortened Thai name, I think.
That's a shortened Thai name.
Yes. Yes. Right. Chowporn. Yes. Steven, right. We got you. Then we got Calvin Prashad. P-R-A-S-H-A-D.
Uh-huh. Prashad. I want to say not only that this person is, I think this person is South Asian and then South Asian. I recently learned that sometimes South Asian people have white sounding names if they're from South Asia. Something I just learned.
Oh, wait, you're talking about like people from like Sri Lanka?
Or something, yeah.
There's some sort of
Christian thing going on back there. So sometimes they got like names like that.
Okay, so Calvin, you are from Sri Lanka.
So shouts to Christianity. I don't know. There you go.
Yeah, I had a friend in high school. He was from Sri Lanka, and his name was like his last name was like Fernando or something. So something happened there. Something happened there with the Spanish people.
Hey, I'm not thinking something good either.
It was not good.
Something bad happened.
And lastly, we have John Han, H-A-N, which I think is a Chinese name.
That's a Chinese. It's Chinese? I might be Korean.
Is it Korean?
I don't know. You know how they have Han?
I don't know. We know Misha Han. He's Chinese. Maybe he's half Korean. Okay. Shit, I don't
know.
Anyways, by the way, if you donate to our Patreon, we try to guess your ethnicity based on your last name. Very racist game, but
we're not just trying to be rude. Yeah, yeah, this is just how we are.
It's a game that we play, and it's very problematic, but this is how we start the podcast. Let's get to the story of the week, man. Let's get to the story of the week.
Yeah, man. We've been doing Clubhouse, right? If you guys don't know what Clubhouse is, it's like this new social media thing, and it's essentially a conference call. Which I think is hilarious. It's just a conference call that you can start. You follow different people and do those different things. People got all into it because, like, you know, the Bitcoin folks are into it, and what's his name? Elon Musk is kind of getting into it. But there's all these different Clubhouse rooms, and people can start a room for whatever reason. Fumi and I, we've started one about just like Asian dating. I was on a Clubhouse recently where I met some. So we have Andre Tran, who's a comedian. He's also been on the podcast, and he like kind of knows some Vietnamese people. He's like, there's some Vietnamese like comedians he's like tied into, and they invited me into like a Vietnamese like trash talk room, where it was just like you can go in there, and it was like Vietnamese roasting, and it was really funny. The word for roasting, we don't have a word for roasting in Vietnamese, so it was like the literal translation was like Vietnamese grilling, which is delicious. But they had that, and they brought me in there, and it was cool. Everybody's very young, everybody's very nice, but my Vietnamese is essentially zero.
They're roasting in Vietnamese.
Yes, but like, you know, yeah, they're like roasting each other. Hey man, you know, you like are, and I and again, because my Vietnamese is very poor, like I didn't really know what they were saying. I mean, you can tell when someone's talking shit, but I didn't really know. And I was sitting there listening to all these people, and everybody is nice and pretty young. I would say, you know, this is social media, so it's like everybody's like late 20s or something like that. But it was so weird being in that room because, and you always talk about having a Ratatouille moment of like remembering something I don't know, traumatic from your past.
Yeah, a Ratatouille flashback.
That happen, yeah, a Ratatouille flashback of being in a room with Vietnamese people talking shit. You know?
Wait, about you?
And me. Well, that's the thing. Because I don't speak Vietnamese, I don't know if they're talking shit.
Are these your cousins? Like, who are these random Vietnamese people talking shit about you?
Vietnamese people, we just love getting together and eating egg rolls and talking shit. Okay, we just like, I would go when I was a kid, we would go to each other's, we would have a Vietnamese gathering. Vietnamese gatherings are always like, there's a fuck ton of food in silver takeaway trays, like big giant buffet trays. There's a lot of Sprite, sometimes there's liquor if you're into drinking, and then there's a lot of just sitting around and like just gossiping, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I would be sitting there as a kid and I didn't really speak Vietnamese, and then like wind would people would catch on that I don't speak Vietnamese, and then like sometimes they would make me say something in Vietnamese, but they were like, ha, you sound like a GI, ha. And I'm like, this is so traumatic for me.
What a roast.
Yeah, and I was like, you know? So it was just like this kind of feeling. And again, nobody was talking shit about me on Clubhouse, but it was just like the feeling of like being in a room, not knowing what's going on, and like kind of knowing, but not really knowing. You know, I don't know if you've ever gotten that sense.
It's a complex feeling because, I mean, I speak Japanese, but like there are a lot of like I couldn't talk about politics in Japanese, but like there is a I feel like that's like a very immigrant specific thing, because there is like a certain level of betrayal that like only diaspora people can experience, and it's from the people who look like you talking language you're supposed to speak but you really can't, and they're laughing because you don't know it. But you know, you had that joke a long time ago that's like, for a lot of diaspora people, English is our second language, but it's also our only language, you know?
Right, exactly.
It's like that, exactly. Where it's like, yeah, it's definitely like, I think it definitely hurts extra, because it's like, oh no, you're my family. Like, you're supposed to have my back. Like, because when I go to school, you know, those kids pick on me. So when I come home and I'm like eating fucking these spring rolls off these silver trays, like, you're supposed to welcome me, and here they are roasting your Vietnamese. So I totally feel that, man. I mean, we've talked about it 1,000 times. I think that's why a lot of second generation Asian American people are shy, and like they don't not shy, but like they don't feel super confident in their language skills.
I'm not
even if it's okay, they don't feel confident because somebody made fun of them, a family member made fun of them for it when they're younger, and that like sticks with them forever, you know.
100%. So like that was always, I'm always afraid of like, if I were at a Vietnamese restaurant and I would order, like, you know, if I ever am in a Vietnamese restaurant and I order something, you know, oh, I like some pho or something like that, and all of a sudden my aunt pops out from behind a tree and is like, oh, you sound like a GI. Ah, and that's what I don't want. And I'm just like, ah, it hurts. So
your
aunt's
tight. Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to shout to Cole Ling. I wanted to talk about that. And that's like sort of the thing about our podcast. You know, today we're asking, is feeling totally lost all the time Asian or not Asian? And the guest we have today is, I woke up early today, was doing push-ups and stuff. I was like, this is the day, man. We've been waiting for so long. This is it.
The Rocky moment. You're like chugging raw eggs.
I was like chugging eggs and stuff like that. And dude, man, wearing my conical hat. I was like, I'm so excited. Our guest today, and okay. Usually the guests we have on this pod, which we love all our podcasts, but usually the guest on this pod is like, this guy played like the third waiter in the 26th season of, you know,
Doctor Who,
two guys in a pizza place, you know, and this is like, great, you know, or you've seen this guy's butt on Insecure, you know, like, okay, fine, you know. Our guest today is the Errol Arnold Chair of English and Professor of English, American Studies and Ethnicity and Comparative Literature at USC. I did that terrible. He's an author. He's a MacArthur Genius Grant winner. He's the winner of the Nobel. He's the winner of the Pulitzer Prize for his debut novel, The Sympathizer. He now has a new book out, a sequel to The Sympathizer called The Committed, which came out this week. I'm blown away that he is here. He is on a podcast. This is a podcast where me and Fumi once discussed the merits of peeing over the band or through the hole in men's underwear.
That was
this
the whole
is the
episode.
Kind of podcast we're on, and we're now, I can see that our guest is thinking about this. Please help me welcome Viet Thanh Nguyen.
Hey!
Yay!
Hey! Fumi and Mike, so good to be here. You know, I'm grading you guys right now.
Oh, God.
I'm evaluating you. just to make you feel inadequate, if at all possible.
Oh, Jesus, I knew it.
I'm a college professor. I see, you know, guys who look like you all the time. I don't know how old you are. You could be 18 or 40. I don't know, but, you know, college students. You look like college students, basically.
Well,
we're pretty old, but yeah.
although you're very close, it's freaky. Okay, so I guess the first question, are you an over or through the underwear guy? Do you know what mm-hmm, we're talking mm-hmm. about? Over the
yeah,
band
I,
or
I,
through?
I do know what you're talking about, and I'm not going to answer the question. I don't think, you don't have to go there.
I told you this isn't going to be...
Have you done the question? Do you do it standing up or sitting down?
That's We did do that. And what did we decide, Fumi?
Well, I used to stand, but now I sit because I like to be clean. When you sit, it's more better accuracy. It's more considerate if you live with women, especially.
It's much, much more considerate. Yes. Yeah. And if you have kids, you better teach them to sit, because otherwise you're cleaning up after them.
Oh. You're teaching your kids to sit like already at this age, like, so they're gonna go to school. Yet. Not yet.
Okay. Not yet. I'm gonna do it though, because the kid has bad aim. bad aim.
Look at us getting a Pulitzer Prize winner to talk about pee already. Jesus,
I just
Christ.
Love it.
Not mine, but my son's. You have to have certain limits.
We're so excited to have you on here, and I did want to ask, you know, why are you doing this podcast? Because I was doing research, and usually your talks are like, you know, it's Viet Thanh Nguyen, and he's at Harvard, and he's at Yale, and he's at Google. And now you're on this podcast trapped with us for the next hour. Who talked you into doing this? Did someone on TikTok dare you or something like that?
I think you emailed me like 20 times, if I
remember. Oh my God, right. I did.
So
yes.
That was that part of it. So I was like, how do I get this guy to stop emailing me all the time? And then I also, you know, I believe in the people. I'm an Asian American, grew up with Asian American studies, Asian American movement. Got to be down for wherever the people are at. Now it's podcast and Clubhouse, apparently.
That's true.
It's not to say we've got listeners, Viet. It's not a complete waste of your time, but it is not. an interesting career choice. Is all we're saying.
You're actually making me reconsider this. You're making me reconsider this at this point.
Well, I just want to, you know, we're so honored you're here. We're fangirls of yours, and I just, you know, you said you were grading us earlier. Well, we are terrible students. We don't believe in the institution. We don't like school. In fact, but you're a very special person to me, because if you know the podcast, hey, you know that I used to not read, but I picked up The Sympathizer at 27 or 28, and I started reading when I was 28. So
started
thank
reading.
You, Professor Viet, for introducing me to books in 2018.
It went from Holes to The Sympathizer for him.
Exactly.
Wow, that's quite a big leap. Now, did you borrow it from the library, or did you buy it?
My girlfriend at the time had it, and Mike had been talking about it for a long time. Also, two reasons. Mike had been talking about it for a long time, how cool it is, and I just saw it one day, and I was like, maybe I'll give it a try. Also, as I was reading it, this is so crazy. The Sympathizer is one of those books where if you're reading it on the subway in New York City, you will get people to give you a little head nod. Because they're just like, hell yeah, dude. I swear to God, it's the only... I've only read two books, The Giver and this, but I swear to God, nobody was giving me head nods when I was reading The Giver on the train. So it's a great book if you want to make some new friends as well.
I've been on the New York subway. I've never seen my book on the New York subway. I've never seen my book anywhere. Never seen anybody reading my book.
Really?
Yeah, so thank you for mentioning that. Yeah.
That's great. You're on the wrong train. You gotta go where the hot people are. The L train.
Yeah.
That's where it is.
Hang on the G. Yeah.
No, I see other people's books. Like the last time I was on the New York subway, I saw someone reading Min Jin Lee's Pachinko, which is a great novel.
That's a great book. We've
so
had her on the show.
Books,
yeah,
but not mine.
Yeah, yeah. She's
so
a rival.
On the right train. Yeah,
I'm on the right train.
She's great.
No, of course we've had her. We've had her on the show. She's amazing.
There's so many things. I guess the first question I wanted to say, and this is something I've noticed, because a lot of artists think they're funny. But I've watched you on a bunch of things. You were on Seth Meyers, this is back with The Sympathizer. But you're like actually funny. I mean, you know, and your writing is funny. Do you ever think, did you ever want to do comedy? Did you ever think about that? Because you have like some, I would say, chops, you know, in the industry biz. I don't know if you if you've ever thought about that. Did you ever think about that?
I have never wanted to do comedy because if you put me on a comedy stage, I'd bomb completely. But, you know, like no one before the sympathizer, none of my friends would ever have said, Viet's a funny guy. Never. So
really?
I learned something in writing that novel. I tapped into the inner comedian somewhere within me. But, you know, some of the best public speakers out there are comedians, you know, people like Chris Rock, Dave Chappelle. I've certainly watched all their stuff and I've learned from what they've done. So I try to put just a little 1% of what they have into my talks when I go public.
Well, I mean, so you were saying you tapped into something when you were writing The Sympathizer and you came across some funny. I mean, like, did you mean for it to be funny when you were writing it? And in your writing, did you mean to be funny?
Yeah, I wanted it to be funny, but I didn't know if I could do it or not. You know, so I love funny novels and things like Catch 22. That was always an ambition, but it's like, how do you learn how to do that? I don't know. I just tried put funny situations into the novel,
right?
And I mean, apparently they are funny. People tell me that they laugh when they read The Sympathizer.
Well, that's an interesting point because, you know, sometimes I feel like one of the topics we talk on this podcast sometimes or in general is like, can Asian people be funny? Because, and I know that sounds like a ridiculous question, but sometimes I feel like the society doesn't allow us to be goofy. Like, even if you're funny, they're like, you're not supposed to be. And, you know, you've made sort of a career talking a lot about, you know, the Vietnamese diaspora experience and the Vietnam War and colonization. And, like, you know, specifically your three books, which I've also read The Refugee, Fangirl, What's Good. You know, that your three books that you have right now, that's kind of what it's about. And sometimes when you can tap into like the thing that you could talk about for hours, that's where you find your humor. You know, it's like I think as Asian Americans, we watch people like Dave Chappelle and we go, well, I want to try to do that. Well, you can't because you're not a black man. You know, like you have to find, like Asian people have to find what's funny and goofy about their own communities and their own culture. And, you know, hey, maybe that's why The Sympathizer ended up being funny, even though your friends didn't think you were funny, because that's like the thing that you can talk about for hours. You know what I'm saying?
I think what you got to do is you got to be honest about stuff, you know? So I think maybe one reason why, like, maybe a lot of some Asian American comedians or whatever aren't funny is they tell stupid jokes. Maybe, you know, there's only so much you can say about your family and your accent and all of that. It gets tiresome after a while, you know? But like, go back to Dave Chappelle, for example. Like, I watched his debut show like a few months ago, and he was talking about basically he was talking about Black Lives Matter 10 or 15 years before it actually happened, being pulled over by the cops for marijuana possession, being afraid of getting shot, but he turned it into jokes, right? But he was touching directly on like a real vein of black experience. So I'm not going to say anything about that, but in this context, like, you know, some of the stuff that you guys have already mentioned, you know, about, hey, why do Sri Lankans have Christian names? Well, some bad stuff happened. Go there. That's where you got to go to your own history. And you know, I think the most powerful comedy is like when you take something that's painful and you can talk about it in ways that are funny, because there is some humor there.
I feel you. And I feel like there's like a rich vein of stuff. I just started writing jokes. I can't even believe that I'm saying this. I've started writing jokes about the Vietnam War, which doesn't make sense. But to me, there's something so ridiculous about being Vietnamese. We're a Southeast Asian people that were dominated by the Chinese, and now we drink coffee and people love our sandwiches. You just say those things out loud, and those are true, and they're ridiculous at the same time. I don't know if you ever reflect on like how ludicrous the history of us is, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. The fact that your aunt jumps out and says, you talk like a GI. I mean, that is speaking directly to this history of those American soldiers being in the country and doing all kinds of bad, good stuff maybe, but also a lot of bad stuff too. And go there. You got to talk about that. You got to talk about being invaded by Americans, you know, and you'll push some buttons and there'll be a lot of Vietnamese people who are like, you can't say that. You can't say we've been invaded by Americans. They were there to help us. Well, that's exactly the problem. Where the jokes are going
to
come from.
You know, shifting it to you, when you were, you know, writing, and I know that you had written the stories for the refugees like a while back, and then you started writing The Sympathizer, and then, you know, you've been sort of curating or developing this voice. What was it like when you were first writing these stories and then having people go, oh, you know, I don't know if people are going to listen to this? I mean, I know, for example, your thesis advisor kind of advised you not to write about Vietnamese literature or Vietnamese American literature. Did you ever think, okay, well, maybe I need to stay broad, or I need to kind of go where people are going to be able to understand me? Or did you think, oh no, I really do need to talk about this thing that no one has talked about before?
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't think there's any difference between being a writer and being a comedian in the sense of that honesty issue. Like, what do you care about? What do you care about the most? And if what you care about the most is not what my manager or your professor or your audience is telling you that they care about, well, literally, you just have to not care what people are telling you about. You have to make people care what you care about. Mm. That's not an easy thing to do, you know? So writing The Refugees, took me 20 years, which is sort of like the experience, I'm sure, of comedians who are going up on stage and telling jokes and bombing and no one's laughing. And except, you know, as a writer, you do it in private. You just sit in your room and you do it.
You bomb in your room.
You bomb in your room by yourself. But you have to persist. And it's a kind of a lonely endeavor, especially if you're the first person or one of the first people going out saying what you believe in. And I always had to believe that there were people out there who were thinking like me, but our voices weren't being heard. And, you know, it's a catch-22, chicken and egg problem. Like, you believe that your story is important. You believe that other people believe the story is important, but the outside world hasn't gotten to that point yet. And so the outside world is saying, well, we never heard about you, or we never heard about your experience, so why should we pay attention? So in many ways, when you're the first or one of the first, you also have to create your own audience. As well, but you have to believe that there's already that potential audience out there, and I thought that was the situation that I was in.
Yeah, I mean, we only asked that because, you know, I mean, this happens every other month, but like recently, like somebody, we hear this all the time when people are like, "Well, you should change your name of the podcast because it's like, who is this relatable to? Like, you have Asian in there, like that's gonna scare off people. It's gonna scare off white people or whatever." And I was just wondering, because you know, your three biggest books are like kind of about the Vietnam War. I'm wondering, did other authors ever say stuff like that to you? And like, did that hurt you? Because I think in comedy, like, even if you don't believe it, when you hear it, it does hurt, and it does make you kind of question, like, oh fuck, maybe I should just step away from this thing that I really care about because nobody cares. Like, you know, I see what you're saying about like you have to not care, but I'm wondering if there was a young Viet Thanh Nguyen who was, you know, an experienced writer but maybe didn't have the publishing deals or whatever it is, and like, and when publishers would say stuff like that to you, like, did that hurt? Or if people didn't say that to you, I don't know.
No, I mean, absolutely, it's true in every field. You know, I was rereading Kathy Park Hong's Minor Feelings. I don't know if you guys have read that book, but it's perfect for your podcast. So try to get Kathy on board. But you know, one of the things she talks about Asian American feelings and feeling invisible and unheard and all of that kind of thing. And feeling like if you're Asian American, you have to speak to white people. It's really debilitating. And of course, as an aspiring writer during those 20 years that I was trying to write The Refugees, of course I was trying to be a writer, but I was also worrying about whether agents or editors or publishers are going to be interested in publishing this book. And when I say agents or editors or publishers, of course, I mean white people, because that's mostly what they are.
Right.
So Kathy, in Minor Feelings, she also brings up, by the way, Richard Pryor as a model for her, as an Asian woman modeling herself on this black male comedian. And she recounts the turning point in Richard Pryor's career where, you know, he was sort of like a very safe comedian early in his career. And then he was invited to Las Vegas and stood in front of this all white audience. And he just basically said, what am I doing here? And he walked off the stage, and then he became Richard Pryor, because then he started to talk about the things that we now remember Richard Pryor for. And I think that's exactly what every artist goes through. You have a moment where you're confronted with that situation, and you have to be defiant. You have to say, the hell with you. I'm going to do what I want to do. I don't care if you're saying that Asians are not good enough or no one cares about Asians. And I don't care that you have the power to make me a star. I mean, I had that experience in a more minor way when I wrote The Sympathizer, and we sent it out to publishers. It got rejected by 13 out of 14 publishers. And one of the editors who rejected the book, I had a conversation with him for an hour, and I knew he was very powerful and very famous for an editor. His writers had won 2 Pulitzer Prizes, and I knew he could give 6-figure advances. And he said, I like the book, but I think you should make these 2 major changes to the book. I basically said, I don't want to make these two major changes to the book. And he did not make an offer on the book. And then like a month later, I found out he gave a first time author, a woman of color, $1 million advance.
Oh, shit.
Like, if I'd known that, maybe I would have changed it.
You know, hold on here. Let's talk. Hold on. We can negotiate anything. You don't have to tell me, but I would love it if one of the changes was make everybody from South Dakota. That's the change. That's the first one. And the second one, we have to lose the Vietnamese thing. I mean, have you been surprised about, because I think you're totally right about, you know, finding your audience. And for us, it's, you know, our audience is a lot of Asian Americans, but it's also not. It's a lot of, it's all kinds of different people. We have all sorts of different folks, you know, messaging us and then saying they identify with some of the crap we say. I mean, are there people you're surprised that you're like, oh, I didn't know I would connect with this kind of person?
Yeah, absolutely. It's first of all, okay, the Sympathizer sold around 1 million copies worldwide. So that's a lot of people.
Hey,
yeah. Maybe they didn't all read it. Maybe they just bought it and it's on a bookshelf somewhere or whatever. But, you know, a lot of people read it all over the world in 25, 30 languages or countries. So yeah. I'll tell you one story. I went to Italy. The book has done well in Italy. Gave a talk there. And then as I came down off the stage, this woman approached me. And she was very emotional. And she said, you know, your book, The Sympathizer in Italian, was the last book my husband read before he died. You know, and, you know, he was really moved by this book. And she became a reader of my work. And she just, emailed me this morning, you know, saying, oh, I'm thrilled about the Committed coming out in Italian. It's out in Italian right now. Mm-hmm. So there are all these kinds of connections with totally unexpected people from very different kinds of backgrounds. You know, get messages from people who from Australia, from India, many different places. And that affirms for me this idea that even though I've made a career, as you've said, by being a professional Vietnamese, you know, talking a lot about
it's fucking awesome.
You're not
it's
just
really
Vietnamese,
cool.
You're a professional Vietnamese. Yeah.
Yes, there's gradations, you know. You can be amateur Vietnamese, you can be professional Vietnamese and all of that. And that's a whole other topic that we can talk about, the complications of doing this. But what's important here is that I think I've been unapologetic about writing about the Vietnam War, about Vietnamese people, Vietnamese Americans, with the belief that our experiences matter. Not just to us, but to everybody, if we can do a good enough job talking about our experiences. And again, I'm just going to beat on Jonathan Franzen. He's just like my straw man for anybody who's a white author. Like, why should anybody care about St. Louis or the Midwest or sandwiches or whatever? But I don't question that. You know, he's a good writer. And why shouldn't I read Jonathan Franzen, even if I've never been to St. Louis or really spent much time in the Midwest? And vice versa, why shouldn't people like Jonathan Franzen read my books? That's the belief I have to have. And, you know, part of the belief is that, you know, going back to this idea of the war or the refugee experience or Vietnam or whatever, that these are human experiences. You know, it's up to us just to convey that in the best way that we can. And if we do, people who are not like us will also come along.
Well, that kind of leads to the other question we wanted to talk about, because we were reading, you had an opinion piece come out where you were kind of like going at the workshop system, and I'm not super familiar with how this works, but I know that, you know, if you're a writer, and for a while I was like I want to be a short, you know, a writer too, and be like this guy and talk about lobsters and it'll be great. And I knew that the thing to do was to go through this brutal system of going through a workshop, and you need to go to like you need to go to Iowa or whatever the fuck it is and do this whole thing. And I was like, this must be the way to do it, because everybody seems to always talk about it like this. But I would always hear these stories about how very brutal they were, and then I would read the short stories that would come out of these things, and a lot of them would sound kind of the same, and they were good, but they were just kind of like, I don't know how to describe it, angsty. It was like an angsty short story about a white guy and he's getting a divorce. I'm like, all right, cool. There's like a million of these stories. But, you know, you kind of challenged that. And I wanted to just talk about that a little bit more, about like, because you know, your style is very different. I just noticed a little while ago, you don't use punctuations right, you know? I mean, what's going on? I just, you know what I'm saying? So
there are two things that readers disagree with from the sympathizer. Number one, they don't like the squid scene. Okay. one percent of readers who will not go past the squid scene around page 82 or something. And the other thing is, hey, why are there no quotation marks in your book?
Like, no quotations.
Kind of freak out about that, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I don't see any quotation marks when you guys are talking. You're not doing bunny ears in the air. I don't see quotation marks floating on the screen. You know, these are, okay, so basically, these are just conventions. These are rules that we have made up. You know, professors have taught you, teachers have taught you, you've got to use quotation marks. And everybody says, okay, we got to use quotation marks. But there's no real reason for this.
Right.
And so my mindset is, I'm just going to ignore all the rules. I'll take the rules that are useful. I'll break the rules when I want to. And I think this is a sign that you really know what you're doing. Now, if you just break rules because you don't know what these rules are, then you have a lot to learn. But you gotta be able to get to the point that you know what the rules and the conventions are of whatever it is you do. And then when you break them, that can be really kind of fun and exciting. And I see it all the time with my kid. You know, like he's 7 years old, he's learning the rules and everything, but he's also in a state where he does whatever he wants, whenever he wants. That's really creative and fun. And a lot of us, when we get to become adults, you know, we've forgotten that part because we've spent 10 or 20 years in school learning what to do. So when we get to the workshop idea, now the idea of the workshop is kind of democratic. So you put your short story or your piece of your novel in front of a dozen of your peers and your professor, and they give you feedback on that. Theoretically, that can be pretty good, you know, but what if your peers are dumb? I never understood that part. Like, I was like, if I'm paying a lot of money for a workshop, I want to hear the professor. The professor's an expert. Why am I listening to a dozen people who are no more qualified than I am to give me opinions on my writing? That's one problem. The other problem is, you know, this goes back already to the audience question. What if your peers are coming from a totally different perspective, worldview than you are? You know, like, you know, this whole, go back to Aunt Tina jumping from behind the counter saying, you talk like a GI. You know, I get it, but someone who's never met this kind of obnoxious Vietnamese woman who speaks like a semi-broken English may not get it, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's important to have an audience that gets it. And again, if you're Jonathan Franzen and you're surrounded by a dozen Jonathan Franzens, they get it, they understand.
Mm.
So the workshop can work, but there's so many ways in which it just repeats all of the prejudices and inequities that we already know exist in society. It can be really hard for you if you are, you know, here I'm going to use quotation marks, quote unquote, different than the rest of the workshop to get your work understood. And the danger is you come out of the workshop writing not the story about a white guy getting a divorce, but the story about the Asian guy getting a divorce.
Right. Yes.
Is that any more interesting?
Ah, well, you know me, Mike, you know me, right?
I know.
If you know, dude. If you know anything about me, you know that I'm out there. Yes. I'm out there pounding. And a lot of people are like, Fumi, why are you so good at pounding? And by a lot of people,
I always ask that. Yeah. I don't even believe you.
By a lot of people, I just mean Mike. The secret is, it is Helix Sleep Mattress. Helix Sleep has a quiz that takes just 2 minutes to complete and matches your body type and sleep preferences to the perfect mattress for you. Why would you buy a mattress made for someone else? With Helix, you're getting a mattress that you know will be perfect for the way you sleep and pounding.
Everybody's unique and pounds uniquely. And Helix knows that. So they have several different mattress models to choose from. They have soft, medium, and firm. Uh-huh, wink, wink. Mattresses. Mattresses great for cooling you down if you get hot. And even a Helix Plus mattress for plus-size sleepers. Because, hey, man, everybody needs love.
Just go to helixsleep.com/Asian. Take their 2-minute sleep quiz, and they'll match you to the customized mattress that will give you the best sleep/pound of your life.
They have a 10-year warranty, and you get to try it out for free for 100 nights, risk-free. They'll even pick it up for you if you don't love it, but you will.
Helix is offering up to $200 off all mattress orders and 2 free pillows for our listeners at helix.com/Asian.
That's helix.com/Asian for up to $200 off, and when you're doing your threesomes, 2 free pillows.
Now back to this. Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's such a good point. I think in the in the same article we read about this, you also said something that's kind of related to this, where you had warned white American authors not to abandon their trendy political engagement in the post-Trump era and go back to white novels about flowers and moons. And we related to this so hard because in comedy, we always make fun of white comedians because they're always talking about like stop signs and salt shakers. Yes. That's like you know, they're like, that's, you like know, but it's like that Jerry Seinfeld style. And again, to your point about that author, like Jerry Seinfeld is great, but it's like me as a Japanese immigrant who grew up in Ohio, like I gravitate towards people like the Dave Chappelle's and the Richard Pryor's then Jerry Seinfeld sort of, you know, that's like the flowers and moons. Moons are weird. What's going on with moons?
Yeah, what's going on? Like, hey, you know, airlines are funny, you know?
I just kind of wanted to ask you about that quote that you had because it's like it's something comedians talk about a lot as well.
Well, I mean, like I like to be a provocateur, right? So it's not that I don't like poems about flowers and moons. And I was quoting a Palestinian-American poet making the same point. And that was her line about flowers and moons. That, you know, she says, you know, I want to talk about the Israeli occupation versus flowers and moons. So there's a time for flowers and moons. It's great. I do enjoy these kinds of poems.
Yeah, we love salt shakers. Yeah, I get it.
Right. But it's not all the time. And why can't we talk about the Israeli occupation? Or why can't we talk about being a Japanese immigrant in Ohio? Why do we always have to sort of, you know, water ourselves down to be understood? Or why do we have to imitate somebody else to be understood? I would love to hear about the experiences of a Japanese immigrant in Ohio. And I think the point here is that specificity matters. You know, like Seinfeld, his comedy is very specific to being this guy in New York City. And I grew up like as a refugee kid in San Jose, going to the public library, reading kids' books about Manhattan. And I was like, why am I not living in Manhattan? I'm living in San Jose. San Jose sucks. It's provincial. Who cares about San Jose? I want to be in Manhattan, going to do what these kids in New York City are doing. There's nothing wrong with what those kids in New York City are doing, but there's nothing wrong with growing up in San Jose either. But what gets put out before us, you know? So I got no problem with Seinfeld, no problem with Flowers and Moons, but hey, make room for our voices, our specificities, what we want to talk about in the ways that we want to talk about.
I'm gonna start crying. That was a beautiful answer. Thank you so much.
That was good. And it kind of leads into, you know, now into the work. So I mean, just starting from the sympathizer, when I first read this, the whole idea that somebody has two minds and can see from both sides, I think is such a Vietnamese American thing. When I read it, I didn't know that I was this person, you know, but I feel like especially someone, you know, and in the sympathizer, the main character ends up living in Southern California for a little bit and all this stuff. And this whole thing about like, I am, you know, both the Northern Vietnamese and the Southern Vietnamese. I'm both for the Republic and also a communist. And to like always kind of also have this paranoia, it was such a like a crystallization of the Vietnamese mindset. I wonder, how did you even get around to thinking about it like that? Because to me, it just felt like this is how everybody thinks. And it took me reading your book to go, oh, not everybody thinks like this. I gave this book to Fumi and go, if you want to understand why I'm like weird like this, read this book because I'm kind of like this character. And I don't know, you know, like, how did you... Because for me, it's like you were a fish and you discovered water. You know, you just realize this is how it is. Whereas for me, I had to read someone tell me about it. You know, so I don't even know how you like kind of process that. How did you even get around to that insight?
Well, you know, when I was, I don't know how you felt growing up, but when I was growing up, my parents are very, very Vietnamese. Okay, so But I grew up as an American. You know, I came here when I was 4 years old. So I grew up feeling like I was an American spying on these strange Vietnamese people in their house.
Yes.
But when I stepped outside of the house, I felt like I was a Vietnamese person spying on these strange Americans and whatever you know, weird things they were doing.
Oh my God. Yes. I love that. Right? Oh my God. Yes.
But no one wants to hear about Viet's life story. Viet's life story is really boring. Okay. So again, if I had gone to Iowa though, or whatever writing workshop, that's exactly what I would have done. I would have written a novel about this guy named Viet or somebody like him feeling all this angst. But I don't care about that. So I instead created a real spy who would have basically these kinds of feelings, but you know, they would be much more greatly exaggerated. He would be a much more extreme kind of person than I am. And I would put him in much more exciting circumstances like war and refugee experience and all this other kind of stuff. But at the core of it, and this is true for all literature, right? Is that at the core of the plot, of all this excitement, you have to have somebody who you can relate to, whose yes. feelings are real, whose feelings rhyme with yours, even if they're not exactly the same. But so maybe that's where there's a connection between mm-hmm. what the sympathizer is about and your own experience.
The other thing too is, you know, the character of Bond, and he's very sort of blasé about violence, which I also find to be a very Vietnamese thing, especially in the 80s and 90s. You know, growing up, there was a lot of gang violence, and there's a lot of violence that goes through our culture. And I wonder if you could talk about that, because sometimes my parents, the way they talk about violence, they're so blasé about it. You know, they're just like, yeah, I would just, you know, I saw this guy get killed in front of me, or I would kill this guy. And they say it all the time. And then I don't know if it took me a while to realize, oh, parents usually don't talk like this. But Vietnamese parents seem to be totally okay with violence. I don't know if you have thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, this is not stuff that you can talk about with your average suburban white American person, you know, because you're like, well, first of all, like for the majority of the Vietnamese people here in the United States, either they're refugees or they're descended from refugees, you know.
Yeah.
And if you're a refugee, you went through some kind of horrible experience to get to this country. But everybody went through a horrible experience. So there's nothing right. unique about it. So you just take it for granted. Oh, yeah, you know, we were on a boat or we almost died, blah, blah, blah. Oh, yeah, yeah, okay. But if you tell that to your average suburban white American, they're like, oh my God, you poor refugee, you know, and they just can't relate to this experience. And likewise with the violence, I had the exact same experience. I grew up in San Jose in a Vietnamese refugee community of the 1970s and 1980s.
Right.
And a lot of bad things happened, you know, and the people that the Vietnamese were most afraid of were other Vietnamese people.
Yes,
especially
100%.
Young Vietnamese guys. You know, yes. I home invasions. Very early, do not yep. home invasions, right? And do not yep. ever look a young Vietnamese guy in the eyes.
Yes, that was a thing. Yes, I still don't want to look you in the eye right now because I'm a little afraid of you. So yes,
right. You make more than a second of eye contact, they're gonna get in your face, and not just them, but yes. their six buddies too. Okay, at the yes. same time. So yeah, there was a lot of violence, and you know, my family was subjected to that. I had a gun in my face and all that kind of thing. And
oh my God.
So and then I was also always aware that a lot of these older Vietnamese guys were in the army. And how could you forget? They were always wearing their military uniforms.
Yes, all the time.
The death celebration. Why are you wearing a military uniform to the death celebration? Yeah, why are we having this, you know, militarization of a basically a family-friendly holiday, right?
Right, yeah.
But if you know, okay, so I always thought that these guys were really, potentially really dangerous. Because I knew that they were, some of them were trying to organize the counter revolution or the counter invasion of Vietnam. This was actually a real thing in the 1980s. Yep. And when I say they were dangerous, I don't mean to demean them. I mean that is an aspect of being a soldier, of being a part of the military, of being masculine, that in the United States, we respect in American soldiers. You know, we right. like heroicize, we lionize American service members, we thank them for their service. But at the same time, generally, Americans demean the Vietnamese. You know, if
right.
you watch a lot of Vietnam War movies or read American books about the Vietnam War, oftentimes the South Vietnamese soldiers come off as clowns. Mm-hmm, but right. I grew up with these people and I thought they're probably not clowns. They're probably really kind of, they're I don't agree with masculinity in the sense, but they're men. You know, they're soldiers.
Yes.
They fought for their country. All this kind of stuff. So that violence was always there. Like they probably killed people, and they thought that was heroic. And so that's what Bond represents. You know, he represents that for a certain kind of masculine Vietnamese man, this was simply what they did. You know, that they were dedicated anti-communist killers, and that in a different context, if the Vietnamese, the Southern Vietnamese, had won the war. Or at least, you know, at least kept their half of the country, the Southern Vietnamese would be making heroic movies about guys like Bond. He would be, you know, Rambo.
Yeah.
He would be Rambo, right?
Yeah.
And so that's the approach that I had. And the other influence was John Woo movies. John Woo movies.
Yes.
You saw these movies in the 80s, like Better Tomorrow and so on.
Yep.
The Killer. It's that violence is a part of this world, and it's not necessarily bad. You know, good
right.
guys do violence, bad guys do violence. They're mirror images of each other. and they're brothers, despite what sides they happen to be on. And that was a big inspiration for Bond and the other two blood brothers in this novel, that part of the drama is that they have chosen opposite sides without and kept it a secret, and they're committed to their beliefs, but they're also committed to their friendships. And the friendships, you know, where blood is thicker than water, is going to be where the tragedy lies. And to me, this felt very Vietnamese, because like I was in a gang in the second grade, you know?
Yeah, hell yeah, dude.
In the second grade, the kids were already, the Vietnamese guys were already forming gangs.
Like, yeah.
Why am I being forced to choose between sides here?
Already we're in gangs, so, yep.
Yeah, I'm eight. Yeah, that's crazy.
I'm eight. Yeah, are you a Crip or a Blood or what? Yes.
Yeah. I think, you know, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, and this kind of goes back to what you were saying earlier, is like, you know, you're talking about Vietnamese things, but you know, I'm not Vietnamese, and I didn't, to be honest, we don't have a lot of Vietnamese people in Ohio. There are a few, but mainly Chinese and some Korean. And I learned a lot about sort of Vietnamese culture and stuff like that through Mike when I met him, like, you know, 6 years ago or so. But you know, through reading this book, like even when you're talking about, you know, I felt like a spy for Vietnamese people in school. I think anybody who speaks two languages, that's just automatically your world. You know, like I related to the main character in the way that, like, I went to Japanese school on Saturdays where I was like kind of popular. And then when I'd go to American school, people would call me Masa Ching Chong, right? So it's like, I live these two worlds for like 16 years. And then you start to compartmentalize the world and you don't really know who you are anymore. So I definitely read it to them that way. And then I also like how honest you are about, you know, Vietnamese culture, or just like, I feel like there's always a human touch to it, because for example, like in this new book, and Mike, sorry for skipping around, you can go back to it. But there's a page where the main character and Bond go to like a Vietnamese cultural center or something in Paris, to kind of spy on some of the people from Northern Vietnam. And they're like, look, we're doing a lion dance. Or there's some sort of like dancing thing.
Yeah, the culture show is happening. Yeah.
Right. And then the main character's comment is that, you know, oh, isn't it interesting that this thing that we do once a year is considered Vietnamese culture, when there, and you do like a whole page of a roast of Vietnamese people where you just go like, oh, so you're not going to celebrate gambling? Like, what about cheating on your wife, or like beating your wife, or like whatever? Like, you just list all these things that, you know, a lot of Vietnamese
smoking
people.
A lot. Not being there for your children.
People may do that more on a daily basis, but it's like, you know, when it comes to like, let's celebrate our culture, we pick the thing that we do once every 365 days. And I thought that page was like very, very relatable to me. And I just kind of wanted to ask you about, like, you know, just your thoughts behind that part of the book.
Yeah, I mean, like, so like comedy, and I wanted that to be funny, you know, but comedy is like partly about making fun of the people who are powerful. Right. So you do want to punch up, which I think my novels do. And it's like, it's very important for me to make fun of French people and American people and white people and imperialism and colonialism, because they deserve it. But comedy is also about making fun of your own people and yourself. And these are, you have to do all of it. You have to do all of it, you know. And for those of us who are immersed in any particular culture, in this case, the Vietnamese culture, there's a lot to make fun of. A lot to make fun of.
Yeah, oh God.
You know, and I think it's a sign of love to do it. I don't think, you know, we grow up in traditional households being told to be respectful, keep your mouth shut, you know, put the best face forward outside of your own house, but then outside of the Vietnamese community too. And that's great for harmony. And I hope my son does that too. But comedy is about revealing all the bathroom jokes and all the family secrets and everything. So if you're not willing to do that, you shouldn't be a comedian and you probably shouldn't be a writer. You shouldn't be an artist, period, because if you're pulling your punches, you're not going to be any good. So that was the thinking there. Like, you know, at the core of comedy and politics is, or political critique, is the willingness to be honest, the willingness to expose yourself and your own people, and the willingness to take on the more powerful. All those things have to happen.
Even when I was reading that page, I always think about that, because when you say like Japan or Japanese, like, because there was such a cultural movement in the 80s, like people just, you know, they're like, oh, anime, sushi, ramen, like electronics. But like when I was reading that page, I'm like, no, there's all these other fucking things that our people do constantly that are more Japanese, including like husbands not being home ever and like going to these like hostess bars that are like mild prostitution, like just not raising their own kids, like, you know, extreme misogyny in the workplace, like where women are wearing, they have to wear pink and guys wear suits. Like that still happens today. These are things that happen every fucking day that nobody thinks about when they say or hear the words Japan. So totally just that page, I really just really felt that one.
Well, okay, so I mean, let me add something else here. Like, I mean, part of what I was saying on that page is like white people never feel the need to put on culture shows. Why is it
that
Asian Americans always have a culture show? The Korean show, the Filipino show, the Vietnamese culture show.
Yeah.
But and that's because like every day is White Culture Day in the United States, you know, and we know that everything is white culture, everything from the hamburger to the B-52 bomber to Donald Trump, all this is American culture, right? And we have to, whoever we are, we have to do the exact same thing. We have to get off this idea that our culture is something that we celebrate one evening out of the year at the Vietnamese Student Association at UCLA Culture Show for our parents. And that is always going to be about the ao yai and you know, the fan dance and the peasant. I mean, these college students, most of them, you know, have never actually stepped into a rice paddy in their entire life.
I have been to a rice paddy. Not a lot of dancing. Weirdly enough.
Right. And if you're in a rice paddy, you're stepping on like cow shit. I mean, that's not in the culture show, right? So I mean, we have to be assertive, and we have to, like, as you just said, Bumi, talk about every aspect of our culture as if it's always present, not just like something we have to like elevate to you know, some kind of icon. Because that's a sign of weakness. Americans don't have to do that. The French don't have to do that. But the minority, the immigrant, the refugee, feels like they have to do that every once a year. Like that's our special day. Every day should be our special day.
So I went to the same school as you did. Were you in VSA Culture Show? Did you do that? Did they have that? They had that.
They have it at every University of California campus, as far as I know. I mean, I attended three: UC Riverside, UCLA, UC Berkeley. There was a culture show at every campus, and they were always the same.
They're always the same. Did you do any of them? Did you do any of the ox dances? You know?
No. I think everybody thought it was a whitewash. So they thought we can't have Viet up here. It's just gonna.
No, we really can't.
Real.
Yeah, he's an English major. What's the point of that? I love it, and I totally hear you. As far as I always think for this podcast, and I've only just come to this realization that the job of a comedian, especially if this podcast is to defend Asian Americans, as far as like, hey, you know, don't punch us in the face when we're on the subway, but also at the same time to needle Asian Americans, because we're sometimes need to be needled. We need to be like called out on our own shit. And I think like a really good comedian, artist, whatever, I don't want to say I'm an artist, I'm just a dumbass. So, you know, anyone who's going to do that is going to hold their own, their in-group accountable just as much as they hold other people accountable too. So that's a banger. I love it.
You already have a joke. Like the anti-Asian violence that everybody's upset about, rightfully, we should talk about it. But you can actually joke about that. You're like, you know, hey, don't beat up on us, because that's our job. We're supposed to beat up on ourselves. You know?
Viet, look, hey, I'm telling you, man. You know what? You want to go on tour? We can get this special going. All right, we can.
You know what? Yeah, let us open on your book tour.
Let us open your book tour.
That's not a bad idea. Yeah, I never thought about having a stand up.
We would bomb in Italy. We can't do stand up in Italy.
We are with our amazing guest, Viet Thanh Nguyen. He's got a book out called The Committed. But the first game we're going to play with him is called Rate My Pulitzer Prize Winner. And so what we did was we went to ratemyprofessors.com and we found him. And by the way, there are many Viet Nguyen's professors. None of them are ethnic studies or English studies majors or professors. They're all like finance professors, math professors. And then, so it was very easy to find you, because I was like, there was only one who teaches English. And so we found some of your reviews, and the game is we're going to read what the person wrote about you, and then you have to guess at a scale of 1 through 5 what they gave you. How's that sound?
one is the bottom and five is the top, right?
One is the bottom, five is the top. Mm-hmm.
All right.
Okay, so in this first one here, this was a while ago. I don't know how much you teach because like a lot of these were really old, but this is from 2014. Okay. Pretty solid teacher.
That's it.
That's it.
That's it.
A three.
Yes, there you go. You got it. Perfect. You got a three, and it does say here average. That's one of the emoticons I guess they can put on here. Okay, here's another one. Okay, here you go. So, this will be good. This is a very recent one. If you expect a typical history class, don't take this class. You'll read a bunch of weird romance novels, especially if you're a science, business, or foreign student, you will regret it. Prof and Tia are very biased, and they think they're the most powerful people. It's not like you can learn chain rule in calc and get to know apply. Very subjective class. Okay, so I think this person needs to take the class again, for sure. That's the first thing. But what do you think? And also, what class is this?
This is I teach a class called the American War in Vietnam, which fulfills a general education requirement. So that means class is 150 students and approximately 30% don't want to be there, at least. Mm. So there's nothing I can do about it. You know, like I try my hardest and then I think, and there's nothing I can do to reach the 30% of the class who either sits in the back or never shows up in the first place.
Yeah,
so I assume this person gave me a one.
Yes. Wow. Wow. You're very perceptive. Yes. And they gave you the awful emoticon.
This is like an international student, though, I think, judging from the grammar, I feel like.
I would say so. I
generalize and stereotype about my international students, but I do have quite a few. But I don't think they're all like that.
No, I don't think so either. What is these weird romance novels you make them read? Are you making them read like, you know, what is that?
What I'm saying is I don't know if this person ever read more than a page of the books that I assigned because there are no romance novels. So the closest that came to it, I mean, we're talking, what do I have them read? I'm going to read Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carried, Boutonin's The Sorrow of War, Calclea Yang's The Late Homecomer, which if you never read the book, you might think maybe it's a romance because it has a girl in it. And then Lily Hayslip's When Heaven and Earth Change Places, which is, there is romance in that book. That's right. Like the only book where there's romance, but mostly it's about war and being a refugee.
Here we go. We'll just do one more. This will be a tricky one. So I took this class on pass, no pass basis because I knew everything will be graded by my discussion TA, which was so subjective, I think. Professor Nguyen is such a caring professor, but I did not really understand what this course was trying to teach. Not history for sure, though. Oh, and a lot of ridiculous reading, my dudes. Ends with my dudes.
Here's a hint. This person rated your class 4 out of 5 on difficulty.
Difficulty.
Oh, I assume they all rated it like 4 or 5 out of difficulty. You know. So basically, the takeaway is Viet sucks as a professor. That's all right.
They seem to like you.
Yeah, I got a Pulitzer. Mike. I don't need to be a good professor. I got the Pulitzer. Okay.
Yes. Yo, get that tenure money, baby. Get that tenure money.
What's good? I'm the chair. Yo.
Oh, okay. So I'm going to guess they gave me a 3.
They gave you a 2. Yeah. Okay. Oh, come on.
I gave them a C, so it's all equal.
Ooh, damn. Okay, so that was our first game. Here's another game. This is a sillier game. Our guest Viet Thanh Nguyen has a book called The Committed, which is the sequel to The Sympathizer. So we went on to goodreads.com, and I know you don't read the reviews. You don't read the reviews, which is great because we read the reviews. And so what when I was doing research on this book, I found out that there are if you type in The Committed, there are two books that come up. One is The Committed, your book, and the other one is The Committed Side Chick, which came out, I believe, in 2018. Now,
see that book. Yes,
he saw it, but he didn't read it.
Yeah, are you a fan? I'm not sure.
No. I mean, it didn't seem like my genre, so it would seem unfair for me to read and to give that a Goodreads grade.
Oh, come on, refugees and side chicks. Come on, that's a good brand for you, man.
I'm going to read a review And you got to tell me, did this review come from a review? Is this a review of your book, The Committed, or a review of The Committed Side Chick? Okay. Okay. Let's see here. So here we go. I hate that I have to wait for part two to come out. Like, I wish they could just tell us what the release date would be. This book was so good. With all these different characters going through their own issues, I was never confused. That's it.
That's the key giveaway. I was never confused. So that is definitely a review of The Committed Side Chick.
Yes. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And yes, so you got that one. And it is true. The Committed is confusing, but in an awesome way, where it kind of like when you smoke a whole bunch of sativa and then you're not sure what's going on. That's really what it's like. So if you're a fan of sativa, pick up the book. Okay, here's the other one. And the truth is, I don't like this book. I was so confused half of the time and exhausted in the other half. I'm not saying what I typed below was lying. She goes on and types for a while. It was just an extreme effort to utter out what positive things I could be said about this book without spoiling anything, since I saw so many people praising it and I'm scared to be offensive to those people who have read it. This comes from a Vietnamese, by the way. It's good to see a Vietnamese author with such writing, but also sad because it felt so foreign to me. Dang.
Oh, well, think that's obviously a review of The Committed.
Yes, it is. There you go.
Are you sure?
Yeah. I don't know. Are you sure? You know?
Well, who, maybe people also love side chicks. Maybe the side chick was Vietnamese. I don't know.
You know, your worst critics are always your own people, I think.
Yes.
That's a good point. Yes. That's a good point.
Well, I wanted to ask you, I mean, this is something I wanted to ask before was, did you get a lot of, because when I read this book and, you know, it's called The Sympathizer. It's in red. I couldn't take this book home with me when I went to go visit my parents. And I was like, Viet, he is going to, like, you know, if this was the 80s or 90s, you would have to go into hiding. You know, I mean, did you get a lot of shit from Vietnamese people, who, you know, whether the older generation or whoever, you know, when this book came out?
Well, you have to assume that people read books, which they don't. So I don't think it really matters. You know,
double
so.
Shots fired, son.
But to the extent that, you know, when they did find out that it was like from the perspective of a communist spy, I think obviously a lot of people said, we're not reading this. And certainly on Facebook and Instagram and I've been called a communist or a commie by Vietnamese people quite a lot. Doesn't bother me. But you know, I think that there are Vietnamese people of the older generation who've actually read the book, and if they're not rabidly anti-communist, a lot of them do seem to get it from the reviews that you're not going to read. You might see some of that evidence in there, but the last thing is, you know, again going back to this idea that your worst critics are your own people.
Yeah,
I'll never forget the time. I went back to San Jose, you know, this is the homecoming, went back to San Jose,
yeah.
Went to community college to do an event at the invitation of the community college, you know, and then in the signing line, this older Vietnamese gentleman came up, and he was probably like 70 years old, and he just sort of stood there, and he sort of, you know, picked up a book, one of my books, looked at it, sneered, put the book back down, and said, you don't really know what you're talking about, do you? You know, so in Ooh. Vietnamese, right?
Yeah, so, yeah. Like,
yeah, but that's to be expected. I think that, I don't know. I on the one hand, I get a lot of very positive feedback from Vietnamese American people, and even from people in Vietnam or international students from Vietnam. But then there are always going to be those people who are pissed off at me for one reason or another. This comes with the territory.
Yeah. I wanted to close with, you know, I'm sure you saw the riots, right? The Capitol Hill riots, and then of course our people were representing, you know, because hey, we love diversity, right? So we it's funny because I'll see the South Vietnam flag there, and to me it makes perfect sense. And I know a lot of people are like, why are they there? What's going on there? And I don't know if you had any thoughts about it, because it's in a weird way it actually made me feel. Not better, but it was interesting seeing that flag because I feel like I understand those people. I don't agree with them. I get what's going on there. And I feel that I might be able to reach them and talk to them about something. But But I don't know if you, I don't know what your thoughts are on seeing some, when you saw those flags up at the riot, you know, were you sort of like, you know, crestfallen about that? Were you sort of, you know, it is what it is, or more importantly, do you feel like there's a way to reach those people? Because I feel there's got to be a way, you know.
Wow, you're asking for hope. I'm not good at hope.
You're a comedian. Okay, go ahead. Yes.
No, I mean, like, I don't think I was surprised to see the flag there. Because I'd had a very active Facebook page in the fall of 2020 with like 93,000 people following it, and a lot of them were Vietnamese, and I got into so many fights with Vietnamese and Vietnamese American Trump supporters.
Yep.
And so I already knew that there was a very strong support for Trump in Vietnam and here in the United States. And they're very angry. They're very angry. And they're very prone to using, you know, violent, foul language. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, it was a disappointment to see the Vietnamese flag flying there, but not a surprise. And I think that can, you know, there are a whole bunch of flags flying there, a lot of American flags, a lot of, you know, Confederate flags, and a lot of like flags whose symbols I didn't really understand, but which are apparently, you know, signs of white supremacy. And then there were a lot of other countries' flags there too. So the Vietnamese were not the only non-white people there, but I think we were like the largest contingent, as far as I could tell. Or maybe I'm just looking at the right Facebook feeds where
maybe
whole van loads of Vietnamese people are all very proud and happy waving the Vietnamese flag. And there's a lot of reasons for that. You know, I think the Vietnamese American community was caught up in Trump fervor, just like 50% of the country was caught up in Trump fervor for all the various reasons that we know about. And then that's compounded by at least two things. One is that, you know, Trump support is sort of inevitably tied up with racism and white supremacy and anti-blackness. And unfortunately, I think there's a lot of racists in the Vietnamese American community. That's what I heard growing up, you know.
Yep.
Still hear it. And oftentimes said in Vietnamese rather than English, but nevertheless, it's out there. And then the last thing is that I think a lot of Vietnamese Americans who are refugees are deeply patriotic about South Vietnam. Mm-hmm. That's why they wear the military uniforms. That's why they sing the national anthem, wave the yellow flag at all the Vietnamese events. There's a lot of nostalgia for that lost country and that war, which has, a little bit of similarity to how some Americans feel a lot of nostalgia for the Confederacy and feel like they lost a just cause, and that's why they can still wave the Confederate flag. And so there's that too, that sense of that sense of defeat and anger and pride and the desire to take things back.
Right. Damn, dude. Fumi, do we how what do you think? Are we almost done here?
Yeah, I think we're done.
We were supposed to
end with a funny game, and then Mike brought up a really sad thing at the end. So I was like,
I just had so many things to talk to. I have so many more things we could talk about. I mean,
I cannot believe you guys asked me about peeing, but you didn't bring up the squid in the sympathizer. It just seems like
it was so funny. Our producer was like, she was doing research on it. She's like, "Oh, is it true that he's got a chapter about fucking a squid or something?" Or the sympathizer. That's like the only part she read.
You do.
Let's end on that note. Yeah.
Maybe.
All right.
Honestly,
I don't want to have the last word to Vietnamese Trumpists on this show.
Okay. Fine.
You want to talk about
the last
fucking
word to having sex? Squid fucking.
Yes.
Okay.
And let me just say it's semi autobiographical, not completely autobiographical, but semi autobiographical.
And you know what? I understand that, and I understand for you. That must have been like an anti-colonial message to the Japanese because you're fucking a piece of sushi. And I get that. That was a political message, Viet. And I get it. And I respect it.
It's a step above that moment in the movie Rising Sun where like the Japanese evil guy eats sushi off a white prostitute's body. Now, that's just racist, okay?
Right. Yes.
But in this case, a Vietnamese guy, teenager, losing his virginity to a squid is, I think, a sign of love for Vietnamese food more than anything
else. You're right.
Else. The yeah. stuffed squid. He stuffs the squid in more ways.
You ever fuck? You ever fuck your food? You ever fuck your food? You okay? Just think about that. All right.
He added. He's adding his own spices on it, and that's a great thing.
What I love too is
exactly what happens, and then of course he feeds it to his own family.
All right. Well, Netflix special is coming out pretty soon, so be sure to check that out. If you love things like squid fucking and Trump supporters, it'll be great.
That's actually the name of his special. It's called Trump Supporters and Squid Fucking. So check that out.
Squid Fucking
on Netflix this summer. Thank you so much for doing this podcast.
Thanks,
you know, this has been amazing.
Guys. If I had to rate you on Rate My Podcast, you would get 1.5. Sorry, 1.5 is what you guys would get.
Honestly, that's a lot better than we thought, so that's totally fine.
That's very true, actually.
What do you want our fans to know about you? Where can they get the book? Do you have anything cool things coming up that they would like to that you'd like to share with them?
Where can they find you, et cetera?
I'm on virtual book tour, which means I'm appearing in a dozen places from my office where I'm doing this podcast. So you can catch me at all those places. And Committed is out. And I don't know. That's basically about all I'm doing with my life right now and appearing on your podcast.
There you go.
Yeah.
Get
a copy of The Committed.
I've been drinking a lot.
What do you? Absolutely. Okay. That's a whole other section I wanted to talk about too. But I mean, you know, like. I always see that I've watched a couple of your other, you had one, was it with DVN or DVAN? Is that like an organization?
Diasporic Vietnamese Artist Network. I do a show called Accented Dialogues in the Diaspora, and we always have cocktails there.
There you go.
Including, by the way, I'll give a shout out to our resident mixologist. Find her on Instagram, Mixaphoria with a PH. And she has great cocktails that we use for our show. And I've just been, you know, ordering from her, actually. So she'll deliver cocktails to my door.
Wow. There you go. Well, you should probably also see someone about that. So possibly good.
Okay.
But thank you so much for having us. You know, the book is amazing. It's called The Committed. Please check it out. Please check out Viet's work. I think you're going to do all sorts of fun stuff. I mean... I don't know. Hang out sometime?
I'm graduating from your podcast to Seth Meyers in about a week, so there you
go.
Hey, we scooped Seth Meyers though, son.
You know
what's
what?
Good?
Hey, don't knock us, bro. We're gonna have our own show soon, and then hey, we'll see if we'll book you again. Okay, we shall see.
Thank you very much, man.
Thank you very much, listeners. Thank you so much for listening. Check us out on Instagram at Asian.AsianPod. I'm also on there at the Fumi Abe. Thefumiabe.
And you can find me on Instagram at Nice Pants Bro.
Check out our stand-up comedy show, Hack City, every other Friday. The next one will be March 19th, and the one after is April 2nd. And then if you've joined the Patreon, we've got a Patreon-exclusive hangout happening on March 12th. So definitely check us out at patreon.com/asian.asianpod. Viet, this was super awesome. Thank you guys so much. And Anals, we'll see you next week. Bye.
Bye.